Hi, and welcome back to Occupy America's Radio Network. This is episode 34 of Occupy Interview, and our guest today is Sam. Sam, can you introduce yourself, please?
Yes. Hi. My name is Sam Bahour. I'm originally from Youngstown, Ohio. I'm a Palestinian American, and I currently live in the city of El Bire, which is right next to Ramallah in the West Bank of Palestine, about 8 kilometers north of Jerusalem.
We wanted to kind of talk to you today because this will be the third year for Occupy America, and that first word, Occupy, with the title for this show is Occupy Occupation. Can you explain to us what is an occupation in reality?
Yes, I thank you for calling it that because it can draw attention to the word occupy as well, because when the Occupy movement started, it took on a positive connotation, that it was proactive to end something that was wrong, whereas here, when we say occupation, what we refer to is a military occupation by the state of Israel upon Palestinian lands and Palestinian people. This military occupation by Israel has been in place now for 47 years. It started in 1967, and we have been, as Palestinians, struggling to end this military occupation by many different means. This is the focal point right now of the Palestinian struggle for freedom and independence. I should note that the military occupation that we're struggling against is only one component of the issue here. We also have two other very important components or elements of our struggle. The second being, after ending the military occupation, which having gone on for so long is actually an illegal occupation. I'll get to that in a second. But the second element of our struggle is to end the institutionalized discrimination that happens inside Israel, not in the West Bank and Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem, which are occupied territory, but rather inside Jerusalem. There are 20% of Israel, inside Israel, there's 20% of Israel's population are non-Jews, mainly Muslims and Christians, and they're Palestinian for the most part. And Israel structurally and institutionally discriminates against them. Think of African Americans throughout the civil rights movement, maybe even till today in the States, where discrimination is rapid, but over time, it becomes institutionalized and hidden from the naked eye. That's the second part of our struggle, which is to end discrimination that happens against our fellow Palestinians inside Israel, who are Israeli citizens, because they did not flee their homes as many other Palestinians did when Israel was created. The third element of our struggle for freedom and independence is to bring back the Palestinian refugees, which were forced out of Israel when Israel declared its independence. At the time, that was about 750,000 people. That was half the population back in 1948. Today, those individuals that have fled and are refugees and their descendants, given they've been sitting in refugee camps for the last 66 years, ever since 1948, now number close to 5 million. So the third component of our struggle for freedom and independence is to see that those Palestinians, both Muslims and Christians, get back to their homes inside Israel, or if they happen to come from the West Bank. It is their individual and collective right under international law to be able to go back home. And Israel prohibits those refugees from re-entering the country. They prohibit them from re-entering Israel, and they also prohibit them from even entering into the West Bank. So those are the three components of our struggle. Again, the military occupation being only one of the three.
Your background is in history. You co-wrote an oral history. That was how I came to originally meet you. Can you give us an overview of after Oslo? Why did you return? And kind of talk about that part of the experience,
sure,
if you would.
Sure. I should note that my background is not really history. I'm a history buff and a student of history. But my background is actually in computer technology. That's my education and training. And I actually worked in the States as a software developer for many years before I relocated to Palestine, where I actually came here to be able to contribute to establishing the first telecommunications company in Palestine. So that's from a background point of view personally. What happened from this Oslo process that we keep hearing about, sometimes it's called the Oslo process, sometimes it's called the Oslo Peace Accords. What that was back in 1993, the Palestinian side and the Israeli side, for the first time in history, came to an agreement and signed this agreement, which is called the Oslo Accords, in Oslo, the city of Oslo. And that then was signed again in the Washington, D.C. on the White House lawn in the historic handshake between the two sides. What that agreement was not, or we should start by saying what it was not. It was not an agreement to end the occupation that Israel sustains until today, but rather it was an interim agreement. It actually had a date associated to it of 5 years. And within that 5-year period, the Palestinians were supposed to negotiate with the Israelis to be able to interim into statehood, to move from the state of military occupation to a national state of Palestine without an occupation, without a military occupation. Those 5 years witnessed a lot of ups and downs. For Palestinians, there were mostly downs, because from day one, Israel started to violate that agreement, blatantly violated. Now that more than 20 years have passed, much has been written and analyzed about the failure of those Oslo Accords. And it's clear that although there are no angels in this conflict and everyone has made mistakes, by the overwhelming majority, the mistakes which have caused that agreement not to reach a Palestinian state and the end of military occupation has been Israel's military heavy hand on continuing to control every aspect of Palestinian life. When that agreement took place in 1993, the agreement was between two sides, the State of Israel and the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, which is the formal official representative body of the Palestinian people. And it's very interesting to ask a question here. Why did Israel sign an agreement with its arch enemy, the PLO? Why then? Why at that specific moment were they able to come to terms with the Palestinians being represented by the PLO? And there's only one answer to that question. And the answer is Israel agreed to sign this agreement because the Palestinian side first recognized the State of Israel. And to many people, that sounds odd, because now, 20 years later, we hear Israeli officials continue to say, like a broken record, that if the Palestinians would only recognize the State of Israel, things would be so much better. And I kind of chuckle when I hear that, because the person saying that knows nothing about what happened historically within the Oslo Accords. The Palestinians not only recognized the State of Israel, they put it in writing. Not only did they put it in writing, but the Israeli Foreign Ministry actually took the letter that Yasser Arafat, who was leading the PLO at the time, sent to the Israeli Prime Minister and put it on their website. So you can actually go to the Israeli Foreign Ministry website and read the letter that the Palestinians recognized the state of Israel with. That's why Israel accepted to enter into an agreement with the PLO, who up until that point was their arch enemy, and they had refused to recognize or discuss with the Palestinian Liberation Organization. So from that point forward, the Oslo Accords, which are a set of documents which are structured in terms of many, many annexes. There's an annex for every sphere of life in the Oslo Accords. Let me give you an example. There's an annex about how Palestinians and Israelis will deal with agriculture, how they will deal with land, how they will deal with security, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The one that caught my attention was Article 36, and that was an annex that dealt with telecommunications, which is something related to my background educationally. And when I read that first paragraph of Annex 36, and I'll use it as an example here to give you an idea of how the entire agreement was structured. That first paragraph in Article 36 about telecommunications said the following: that the Palestinian side has the right to build, operate, and maintain separate and independent telecommunication networks. And I should note, those are the exact words that are used: separate and independent telecommunication networks. That sounds pretty positive and pretty forward-looking. And to make a long story short, those words brought me to Palestine. I didn't return to Palestine. I relocated to Palestine because I'm an American citizen born in Youngstown, Ohio. So I came back to the home place of my father. I actually live in my father's ancestral home. And at that point, I was part of a team that put together the first telecommunications company here. It's called the Palestine Telecommunications Company. It's the largest private sector employer in Palestine, even till today. And we put that company together, even though the agreement did not help us. And the reason it didn't help us is because although that first paragraph was very positive, the next four pages of that annex were all the buts, all of the things that Israel remained in control of. And if you have time, I'll give you a few quick examples, because it's very enlightening to see how this one sector was dealt with. And if you think about the structure being the same for all the different sectors in the agreement, you begin to understand why the Palestinians never had a chance to exit from this occupation because of Israeli control. Some of the buts in that annex were things like frequencies. You know how mobile phones work. There's no wires connected to them. They work with a connectivity between frequencies using the electromagnetic spectrum. Well, right. Israel said in the agreement, although you have the right to build and operate and maintain separate and independent telecommunication networks, when you want frequencies allocated to you, Palestinians, you have to come back to the Israeli side. And the Israeli side alone will decide if we get access to the frequencies that are above our heads. The frequency, the electromagnetic spectrum, the air above our heads in Palestine is just as militarily occupied as the land, which is just as militarily occupied, by the way, as the water underneath the land. So Israel refused to give us frequencies for many, many months. And when they did accept to give us some frequency allocation, they gave us much less than we need to build an optimal telecommunications network. That means that we spent out of our ears to be able to build a proper network, money that should not have needed to be spent if we had enough spectrum, if we had enough airspace to be able to build a proper network. another example of one of the butts in that annex. The Palestinian territory in the West Bank, in the agreement, the Oslo Agreement, was separated into three different categories of land, areas A, B, and C. Areas A were the populated Palestinian city centers. Area B were the Palestinian rural areas. Area C was 62% of the West Bank, and that remained in total Israeli control, off limits to Palestinian development. The best way I can explain it to you on the radio is to tell you, if you know what Swiss cheese looks like, the Palestinian cities were the holes in Swiss cheese. The cheese itself was Area C, the part that Israel remained in total control of. Why do I explain all this? Because when we wanted to build a telecommunications company, the first thing we wanted to do is to connect our Palestinian cities together. We wanted to connect Ramallah to Bethlehem, for example, or Bethlehem to Jericho. And to be able to go from one hole in the cheese to the next hole in the cheese, we had to cross through Israeli territory. The agreement required us to go and get Israeli approval every single time we wanted to lay a fiber optic cable or a microwave link above Area C. So Israel had full control on the pace of our development. Israel had and continues to have full control on how much restrictions that they put on our sectors, which makes us pay more to work around those restrictions. So that's an example only of one sector, and I can go on and on. But again, I think what I said gives a good enough expression of how the Oslo Accords just codified the military occupation, keeping all of the strategic decisions in the Israeli hands, and more importantly, kept all of the Palestinian natural and economic resources in Israeli control. So the Palestinians basically were set up for failure. Despite that, we did the best that we can do. And we built the company, even though it cost us more. We went and requested all of the approvals that we needed. Even when they didn't give it to us, we would go back 1,000 times or find ways to work around it. And those 5 years of the agreement have dragged on now for nearly 21 years. So even though the agreement formally ended, Israel just kept the same state of affairs and dragged on. And in front of the world, they keep telling the international community that they're negotiating a peace agreement. It's just taking longer than necessary. However, on the ground, they haven't stopped for one day in complicating our life, humiliating us on a daily level, and more importantly, creating facts on the ground. Whether those facts are military facts, like military checkpoints or walls or fences, or the Israeli Jewish-only settlement enterprise, which basically builds homes for Jewish citizens only throughout the West Bank. All of those are facts on the ground that Israel continues to create using this political peace process as a cover. Well, that cover has now been exposed. The Palestinians now are refusing to continue to talk peace with Israel as Israel continues to build a reality on the ground that basically is eating away at the Palestinian future state. And that's where we find ourselves today.
We're about 34 minutes into the show. Can you give our position now is the whole world is occupied, not to the extent that you guys are, but we're all getting too much of a taste. Can you give us an idea of what's a commute like in an occupied territory?
What's the commute?
Yeah, just for you to be able to go to work one day. Can you give us an idea of the delays that throw off economic development? That's part of being occupied.
That's a very good question. Every area of the West Bank called, or the Gaza for that matter, called Area A, which is the Palestinian population centers, are right. surrounded by the Israeli military. Every single Palestinian city is an open air cage. We are surrounded by either a wall. Israel built a 10-meter wall in Palestinian land in the West Bank. So that covers a large part of the territory. We either have the wall or Israeli settlements surrounding our cities, or Israeli military checkpoints, or Israeli fences, or Israeli ditches. We live in a military reality where every Palestinian city is enclosed. So for me to go from my city of Ramallah to Bethlehem, which I would hope that your listeners know, to be able to make that trip, which in normal time, that trip is literally about 17 minutes from my house. I can go from my house, where I'm speaking to you from today, and drive to the Church of Nativity in Bethlehem in 17 minutes. However, after Israel built this wall and put up checkpoints and has rerouted Palestinian traffic all the way down to the Jordan Valley, for me to go south, I need to go east first. And I have to go deep east, and then I go deep south, and then I come back up west to Bethlehem. That trip today takes me at best, an hour and 45 minutes. That's if none of the checkpoints, the Israeli manned checkpoints on the way, don't stop me. There's three permanent checkpoints on the way there. Any one of those Israeli checkpoints can stop me along the way, delay me for as long as they want, or return me back home. So the movement here, to be able to go from point A to point B, is horrendous. One other example, which is an extreme example, which is affecting half of our society here, is Gaza. Gaza is completely hermetically sealed off from the West Bank. Israel does not allow a Gazan to come to the West Bank, nor does it allow a Palestinian from the West Bank to go to Gaza. In some very few cases, they will give permits for people to go to healthcare meetings or whatever, but that's for a very few number. The mass majority of Gazans, for example, are not allowed to come and worship in Jerusalem. They're not even allowed to come to Ramallah. And that's shocking because Ramallah, the West Bank in its entirety, is just as occupied militarily as is Gaza. So how Israel can even divide the occupied territory into cantons and not allow Palestinians to mingle is something out of a Kafka kind of approach. So this is a very serious thing because we have access to the external world. We have a seashore in Gaza. If we were allowed to tap our seashore, we can do business with the world over the sea, and people can come to Gaza and through Gaza get to the West Bank. Israel does not allow us to use the seashore because they have closed off the Gaza Sea to Palestinians, not only Palestinians trying to bring in ships, but even our fishermen and fisherwomen are not allowed to go out more than a couple kilometers into the sea. Otherwise, they get shot at by Israeli gunboats. So Israel is prohibiting us from having access to the outside world. They're forcing us to live in this closed, encircled, militarily occupied reality, and that has been going on for 47 years. And I think, especially in American audience, sometimes I don't think that we fully understand what it means to live under a prolonged 4 to 5 decade military occupation. I'm shocked as a Palestinian American at the amount of violence that comes out of Palestine. It is so low, I am shocked. Because if 10% of what Israel does to Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, if they did that to Ohioans in Ohio or New Yorkans in New York, I can guarantee you beyond a reasonable doubt that the amount of violence that would be coming out of those communities against Israel would be tremendous. For Palestinians, for 47 years, we wake up in the morning today and we are still begging the international community, i.e. the United States, to apply international law to end this military occupation. As we saw this past July, Palestinians' patience is running out. And if the international community can end this military occupation, the Palestinians will have no other option but to fight and resist Israel in the same terms that Israel is fighting us. I work every day so we don't have to go down that route, because I'm convinced there is no military solution to this conflict. Israel has proved beyond a reasonable doubt that it cannot win by using a military solution. And we Palestinians have proven beyond a reasonable doubt that we will not lose by Israel's military might. So we must find a different way out of this conflict. I believe that way is to use international law as the guiding light and to use nonviolent resistance, economic resistance, diplomatic resistance, boycott, divestment, sanction. Those are the kinds of nonviolent tools that give us an advantage on Israel's military machine. And that's where the Palestinians are now headed.
We've got about 19 minutes left in this show. One last thing I wanted to touch on about just a daily commute to work under occupation, that you don't necessarily, if you set out from point A to point B, know for sure you're going to make it from point A to point B. Is there, I'm going to use the wrong term, a lockdown, but you can get stuck someplace without warning. That's going to mess up your work day.
Absolutely, absolutely. When I have meetings outside of my home city, I'm not exactly sure how to tell the person what time I will be there. And it has become normal practice here to make a meeting saying that I'll be there between 2 and 3. Can you imagine in the States if you had to lose an hour every time you had to make a meeting? It's unheard of. It's absurd. And Israel is getting away with murder, literally, by being able to create all of these complications in our life off of the international radar. They do it for the most part behind the scenes. When something like Gaza happens, the whole world knows about it. But for the last 47 years, the whole world has not seen the incremental encroaching on our rights that Israel has been taking steps towards every single day. And the settlements, which get a lot of attention, are only one aspect of that encroachment. They have also taken control of our water resources. I've already mentioned how they've taken control of our airspace. They've taken control of our agricultural and fertile land. So across the board, they have not left an economic resource for us to be able to develop. And then they turn around and with no smirk on their face, tell the international community that if the Palestinians would only create a better economy, things would be better. So I have to ask the Israeli government publicly. We can do that. We lack nothing. We don't lack capital. We don't lack know-how. We don't lack innovation. We don't lack creativity. The only thing we lack is our freedom and our access to our own resources. So Israel, when are you going to get the boot of occupation off of our neck and off of our natural resources so we can actually develop our economy? They cannot get away with telling people that we are below standard because something is wrong with us. Nothing is wrong with us. What is wrong is Israel has been able to maintain a 47-year military occupation, and it will come tumbling down. Just like the civil rights movement brought racism down in the States and Black South Africa brought down apartheid, Palestinians and those in solidarity with us around the world will bring this Israeli military occupation crumbling down. And it will also come with it the crumbling down of discrimination inside Israel. And with that, the return of our refugees from abroad.
I think that's the most important point I got out of reading back through this section. Again, this will be posted with the with this interview. Your suggestion was I read this backwards, it'll make sense when people click the link and see the articles. But it gives you a historic progression. It gives you an idea how we got from the 90s to here. It's amazing from my point of view how much of this I didn't know, but I think that's changing worldwide very rapidly. It's very difficult to try to keep it depersonalized when you actually have people that you are conversing with by Twitter on both sides of the warfare. So your point was there's never been an occupation ever in history that didn't fall. Hadrian's Wall up in Britain, that didn't hold. Where do you see the future? Two states, one state, that was something I was not aware of, that there were more options here. Can you briefly go into what the two-state, one-state situation is as far as the way you see it from there?
Sure. The Palestinians did not go looking for this conflict. I should start there. The Palestinians were sitting in their homes when Europe created an atrocity which created an influx of Jewish Europeans mainly to come from Europe into Palestine after the Holocaust. And from that point, the Palestinians found themselves on the receiving end of a military might that was much bigger than them and forced, as I said, about 750,000 people out of the country. In the beginning, the Palestinians did what any community in the world would do. We tried to fight our way back and said, this is wrong. You can't kick a community out of their home and say that because you were persecuted in Europe, you're going to take our home in the Middle East. That doesn't make sense to us, and it shouldn't make sense to anybody. But after the entire international community accepted that reality, the Palestinians found themselves in a very difficult position. So what we did historically was made a historic concession. We took historic Palestine, and we said that we would accept, even though I believe there's no justice in this acceptance, but the Palestinian leadership accepted it anyway. We said that 78% of historic Palestine, we accept to be the state of Israel. Even though we paid a very big price for that, we understand that Israel came with the Jewish people, the Jewish persons who came from Europe, came persecuted. They did a major historic wrong with how they dealt with the Palestinian population here, the indigenous population. Nevertheless, the Palestinians said 78% of historic Palestine, you can create as Israel. We've accepted that. It's a historic wrong, but we've accepted that historic wrong. And what we look for is to create our Palestinian state on the remaining 22% of historic Palestine. The entire international community, and when I say entire, I mean every single state in the world, except Israel, has accepted that that is a feasible solution to work our way out. And the Palestinians only 2 years ago went to the UN and got a UN resolution which basically says that the world accepts the state of Palestine as a member state in the UN on the remaining 22% of Palestine. 138 countries around the world said yes to that resolution. 9 said no. The U.S., Canada, Israel, the Czech Republic, the superpower of Micronesia, the superpower of Palau, and the superpower of the Marshall Islands are among those who said no. So now the Palestinians find themselves with the entire world in support of Palestine being able to be created on the 22% remaining, and the superpower, the United States, falling into bed with Israel by saying, no, we will not accept that. And the Palestinians right now are at a crossroads. My children, I have 2 daughters. One is an MIT junior studying chemical engineering, and the other is here in the 9th grade. My children, my daughters, are in front of a historic decision. They are about to drop their bid for statehood. They look back at the international community's inability to make that resolution happen, which is a resolution that has been passed in the UN over and over and over again. And my children are looking back and saying, even though international law and UN resolutions are on our side, there is no implementation mechanism to make it happen. So my children are looking forward and saying, maybe we are too weak as Palestinians to create a state. And maybe we should drop our bid for statehood and request our rights. That would be the equivalent of looking at Israel straight in the eye and saying, Israel, you win. We're in a conflict and you win. You get Israel, you get the West Bank, you get East Jerusalem, you get West Jerusalem, you get all of the water, you get all of the airspace, and you know what else you get? Us. Now, we heard you have free health care in Israel, thanks to the U.S. subsidy. Where do we pick up our medical cards? And we want some of that free education, too. So what my children and her generation, their generation is about to do is to drop their bid for statehood and start asking for one single state with one person and one vote. Sound familiar? Yes. It's like the United States of America. And next time I talk to you, I won't be begging you to help me create a state. Instead, I'll come to Savannah, Georgia, and be asking for your support to allow me to sit on the same bus as an Israeli. You think that will resonate with an American public? I do.
The whole world is watching. That might make
absolutely.
All the difference this time. It's absolutely amazing to me to have taken a closer look at the history and taken a closer look at the parts of the history that I wasn't really looking at before this conflict. It's been the most important part to this to me is there's a way out of this. This occupation is going to end. A friend of mine tweeted that Israel's not afraid of war crimes, but they are afraid of demographics. After all of the killing in the 50-51 days of the latest Gaza, there were more kids born than people killed. So the demographics are not there. The world is completely up in arms and getting very impatient to see change. About 8 minutes left. Tell us something optimistic, please.
Absolutely. I wouldn't be here and I wouldn't be talking to you if there wasn't hope in the future. As you noted, there is no military occupation in history that has sustained forever. And our region knows that very well. The Ottoman Empire, the Turks, were here for 400 years and their occupation even ended. So we have no doubt in our minds that this occupation will end. In addition to that, there's also hope on the Israeli side. More and more Israeli citizens are waking up to the atrocities of this military occupation. There are groups such as Breaking the Silence, which I encourage people to visit their website and support. These are Israeli combat soldiers who have come back from this military occupation and have said, never again. We cannot be doing this in our name. And they're speaking out. There are many, many, literally dozens of refuseniks inside Israel that are refusing to even exit high school and go serve in this military occupation. So there's more and more people who are waking up to the fact that this occupation is on its way out. Internationally, more than half the world came out to their city centers and their streets during the Gaza onslaught in July and supported the end of the occupation. So I have no doubt in my mind that this occupation will end. However, we cannot do it alone. And that's why we speak to everyone that's willing to listen, that we need your help. We need your help politically, we need your help morally, and we need your help in supporting the various causes on the ground to keep us steadfast. And I will end by pointing your listeners to my blog, which is epalestine.com. And there you'll find not only information and a reading list and documentary list, but you'll also find a place to click to donate to something that I have taken up as one of my responsibilities towards civil society. So whether it's that or something else, there's a lot of places to link into supporting Palestine, and whether it's material support, moral support, or ultimately political support, we must mobilize, because as you noted in the beginning of this program, which was very, very accurate, this occupation is a global occupation. Today it's the Palestinians. Tomorrow it will be you in one way, shape, or form, unless we put an end to it. And I know for a fact that together we will put an end to it.
That's about as optimistic as I believe you can get after watching the events that have gone down here in just the last couple of months. I just tweeted an article that should be showing on the website now that you had tweeted on electrical power. I don't know. It seems like your climate there is not quite as severe as it is back here in the Midwest. you do remember our Midwest back here, I'm sure.
They don't know what winter is here.
By the same token, you seem to have a shortage of roof and for sure a shortage of electricity. How do you get through this winter, guys?
That's a very good question. I mean, I ask that about many things here. The resilience that the Palestinian people have shown is amazing. It literally is amazing. I mean, I just posted yesterday on my Facebook a documentary that has English subtitles, unless if you would like to listen to it, about the deaf community in Gaza. And it gave me so much hope, and it showed so much resilience of this handicapped community that above all odds, and above those odds, the bombings that come on their heads from the Israeli military, and they wake up and they look forward to the future. We are a very resilient and resourceful people, and sometimes I'm shocked and I'm very proud that the Palestinian people have been able to sustain for so long and still keep their heads on their shoulders and look forward in a positive way. And you'll find that not only in that one documentary, but in many things if you look deeper into our society.
This occupation is destroying the Palestinian people. This occupation is destroying the Israeli people. This occupation is destroying the world economy. This occupation will end. This wall will fall. And we do thank you for trying to explain to us some of the realities that we're looking at. Got about a minute left. What's the last word, please, Sam?
Well, you had asked me off the air in the beginning about what if I was Secretary of State, what I would do. And I guess the only thing I can point to in closing would be we need to start as the United States by putting our money where our mouth is. It makes no sense that the U.S. government keeps saying that the occupation must end and the Palestinians must be able to have their state, while at the same time we arm Israel to the teeth and we fund them to the tune of $3.5 billion, that's a B, billion dollars every year. Israel is able to provide to its citizens free health care, free education, and subsidized housing, whereas in the States, we have a growing homeless community. We have a devastating health care system. Something is wrong with that equation. Let's start putting our money and our actions where our mouth is and stop funding this occupation, stop funding a country which is in violation of not only international law, but U.S. law. And I think there is a starting point for Israel to start to change its action. We are not out to throw Israel into the sea, as they would like you to believe. We are out to force Israel, if need be, to come in line with the international community, to be a member of these communities of nations which have rule and law as a guiding light, not military might. So we need, as the United States, to be in the forefront, and that will not happen unless the grassroots in America, the Occupy movement, the positive Occupy movement in the States, addresses the negative military occupation movement in Palestine through Congress.
We're watching. The interconnectedness now is absolutely amazing. We had people in Gaza explaining to people in Ferguson, Missouri, how to deal with tear gas. Lord knows from the pictures that some of the people in Palestine have plenty to tell us about that. At the same time, I was seeing tweets saying exactly what you're saying from New Zealand, that this occupation has to end, and it's ending. I really want to thank you, Sam. The links will be up to the things that we've talked about, some of the articles. I urge people to try to take a look at this situation from a historic point of view. Again, he suggests read this backwards, which is easy for us historians. We do everything backwards. I really want to thank you for the help and your patience. You've been a really good teacher, Sam.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks for standing. Please tune in for our next show. We're hoping to get Aaron Frady, who is, you just mentioned, he was one of the original founders of Breaking the Silence. And thanks for standing, people. Bye-bye.